Previously on Floating Space.
I definitely know that my world feels a lot smaller.
700,000 people in London suffering from severe loneliness.
No one has time, no one has money. We're even more acutely aware that these third places have gone.
Welcome back to Floating Space, the hunt for the third places we belong in. Sociologist Ray Oldenburg suggested everyone needs three places in their lives. A first place, your home. A second place, your workplace. And a third place, a place to gather easily, inexpensively, regularly, and pleasurably. Somewhere neutral you can socialize, interact, and just be. This week's search has brought me to the very tall, very exclusive gates of private members' clubs.
A club is the sanctuary of the English gentleman, the place where he goes to get away from his wife. In fact, there's not a wife on this whole sceptred isle who can get a foot through one of those massive doors.
When I hear the words private members club, I'm imagining worn brown leather armchairs scattered around a grand but dusty library. The conversations are lit only by the glow from cigars and green-topped banker's lamps littered through the room. I don't know what movies have fed me this image, because I've never been in a room like that, but my imagination is all I've got to go with, considering how impossible it is to enter these clubs. In theory, members' clubs sound like a great third place to me. They look like beautifully decorated buildings where you can unwind, relax, eat and drink in. A location that's neither your home nor your workplace. And I'm sure you'd meet an array of unexpected and interesting characters. But what are they actually built for? Why, and more importantly, how did they come to be? Let's take a quick walk back to the 17th century. Whew. We're in late 1600s London. The city has reached a population of around 500,000 people. The streets are cramped, the open drains are full of sewage, and the aristocracy and upper classes are in desperate need for a place to socialise and relax in. Obviously away from the commoners in the local pubs and taverns, and of course, away from their families at home. Cue the creation of London's longest-standing gentlemen's club, White's, founded by Italian migrant Francesco Bianco in 1693. It started as a chocolate shop patrons could eat, drink, socialise and, secretly, gamble in, and evolved into an exclusive, men-only, invitation-only club on St James's Street in Mayfair. The establishment was so oversubscribed, more clubs sprang to life across the city. A portion of clubs used to be separated by profession, like the Athenaeum for scholars and philosophers, or the Arts Club for, you guessed it, artists. Now, despite how you may feel about private members' clubs, they have had a pretty big impact on society over the last four centuries. After their introduction, their popularity for elite men boomed in the 18th century as a place to rub shoulders and network with politicians, landowners, and aristocrats. In the 19th century, they're suggested to have inspired the Working Men's Club, a space for working class men to gather for refreshments and recreation. It served as a sort of union to meet outside of the reaches of their bosses. The 19th century was also when members' clubs got their international debut. A side effect of colonialism, you could find members' clubs in India, Hong Kong, Singapore, amongst many, many other places, where a lot of those clubs actually still stand today. And back in London, in the 21st century, you'll find around 60 clubs active and seemingly thriving in the city today. And members' clubs have had a makeover. But has the perception of them?
What are your thoughts on private members' clubs? Yay or nay?
Nay.
I have to say yes.
No.
Nay.
Yay, I mean, they've been sort of a traditional part of British culture for almost hundreds of years. Each one I've been to, I've enjoyed. I think the nay part is they're not inclusive enough and they need to drop some of the rigorous standards and, you know, frankly, weird old traditions.
I'd say anti them.
Why?
Because they're private. I just think spaces that you have to pay and be a specific gender historically to be a part of are things that perpetuate the power structures of society rather than being anything for the benefit of the community or the public?
I have to say yes, because I'm a member or have been a member of more than one private members club. The initial appeal was that I was living in a small flat. I had two young children and I wanted them to have somewhere to run around outside. You know, I like going there, I like swimming, I like having lunch with friends who I usually take there. I haven't really made many friends when I've been in the club.
Stuck up, elitist, and I don't want to pay to be in a space with a bunch of white men.
Have you ever been to one?
No, I have not.
So this is, where's this view coming from?
Completely uninformed stereotypes. And it just feels very establishment, and I'm not a fan of that.
They're exclusive, and they do more, in my opinion, to divide than unite.
Can you tell me more about why you think that?
Historically, traditionally, I think they have become a symbol of the elite and have made class divide quite obvious and in the open. Like, but this is our club, you're not invited into it. The clue is in the name, Private Members Club, and it's something I disapprove of.
It was time for me to actually go and see how these members clubs held up as third places. But man, it was hard to get an invite. Private members clubs seem to be split into what I'm calling the old guard versus the new guard. The old guard is your whites, Garrick Club, really anything still standing from the 19th century or before. There isn't loads of information available about how to join, but from what I can gather, you have to be proposed by an established member of the club with at least one other person to second that recommendation. Then, with the approval of other members, you're put on a waiting list until who knows when. I mean, these memberships are for life. You might remember in 2024, whites and the Garrick Club, amongst others, made headlines over not just their men-only policy, but the men on that list. It wasn't just celebrities and socialites. I see you, Stephen Fry and Benedict Cumberbatch. It was members of cabinet, ministers, judges, even the king, all happily mingling, networking, and upholding the rules of this establishment that believes anyone that isn't a man already running in those social circles doesn't have a place there. On the flip side, you have the new guard, your Soho Houses, Albright, and the Conduit, amongst others. These clubs have taken on a new clientele and ethos. They still have an application process, which you can fill out online, but they seem to care more about your goals, impact, and drivers. I was banking on the whole 6 degrees of separation idea to get me into one of these clubs, and I got close with two potential leads into whites and a few friends of friends for Soho House. The funny thing is, when it comes to opening the door, people were pretty sheepish about divulging not only that they were members, but very hesitant to give a glance inside the clubs. With all the associated prestige, is it a if-you-know-you-know situation? Cool among friends, but not really with outsiders? It seemed to be the case until...
My name is Paul Fonsale, and I am the co-founder and CEO of The Conduit.
I got a remarkable in at The Conduit. The Conduit is a club focused on social impact, self-described as designed for entrepreneurs, investors, and activists to come together and work on real-world solutions. And I have to say, it was beautiful. Tucked away in a little side street in Covent Garden, it's a 6-story building with a restaurant, 2 workspaces, a lounge, a couple of bars, and an events room where they've held talks and panels with the likes of Malala Yousafzai, Diane Abbott, and the founder sat in front of me, Paul Van Ziel. I really wasn't sure what to expect, sitting down for a chat with the CEO, but Paul came in very relaxed, open, and welcoming, sporting a navy knit and a big smile, and seemingly just very happy to talk about the importance of spaces like The Conduit.
I mean, The Conduit is really a quintessential third space. It's designed to be a place where people who are both passionate about and curious about positive social change come together. And it is a place designed to engineer serendipity in the sense that it tries to foster connections between people who might otherwise not know each other. And it is designed to reaffirm our connections between each other, between ourselves and between each other. And so the African notion of Ubuntu, which means I am because we are, contends that we are stronger, more resilient, more creative, happier, more dynamic, more entrepreneurial, more generous, when we have this lattice work of relationships and webs between us affirmed and strengthened. And so the conduit is designed to build a community of people who are interested in solutions to the world's most difficult problems and who are committed to working on those solutions, but to do so in a way that also brings them joy and sustenance and love and passion and engagement. So it isn't a sort of dull, dry, difficult, worthy exercise, but also a place which fuels you and leaves you more energized rather than depleted.
Your vision of community, where did that come from for you? Did you pull that from home? Do you pull that from things you've seen or people in your own community? And do you ever want to bring something like the conduit back to where you're from?
I grew up in a home of great love, and that's a good place to start. But I also grew up in a country which was the opposite of love. It was apartheid South Africa, and it divided people, and it discriminated against people, and it was a crime against humanity. And in that incredible oppression and evil, these remarkable leaders grew up, you know, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, and the anti-apartheid movement. And I had the great privilege of working with, you know, Archbishop Tutu in the next door office. And we had, you know, encounters with Nelson Mandela, which was just, you know, breathtaking and inspirational. And I also saw a revolution in action. And the anti-apartheid revolution was one that was fought, no revolutions are perfect, but by and large on incredibly noble principles, and fought by and large in an incredibly noble way. And so I think I learned from a very early age about what organization looks like and how you mobilize people against evil and for good. And also about how the way you go about achieving something, the way you fight your struggle, will determine the outcome of your struggle. By that, I mean, if you fight a struggle by cutting corners and being unprincipled and being cutthroat and violating humanitarian norms, you shouldn't be surprised that when you've won your struggle, those values will come with you and will haunt the present. But if you fight your struggle in a way that by and large conforms to those principles, you will infuse your new society with those principles.
Access or opportunities shouldn't be exclusive. Obviously, historically, there's a lot of exclusivity and gatekeeping involved in clubs and the access to them. What's different here? Because maybe it is a little bit exclusive still with there's a financial bar, not necessarily with the graduates. I believe that's a free program. But what does that kind of exclusivity mean? Because that word does have a negative connotation, but it's just that it's for some and it's not for others.
So we really try not to think of ourselves as a club, and we really don't like to think of ourselves as exclusive at all. You know, we have a membership fee because the business model requires people to pay a membership fee because we want to be a sustainable business. But we've set it at a reasonable rate. We have two tiers of pricing, a pricing that enables people who are working in social impact who are younger to pay a lower fee than people who are able to pay a higher fee. And I think this exclusivity thing is kind of boring and a bit retrograde, frankly. I think it's, you know, it's like, how really interesting is it to wait behind a velvet rope or try to activate some obscure, opaque network in order to walk through the door? To what end? And if you get your jollies from being able to walk through a door that other people can't walk through in order to hang out with people, in order to do nothing other than to be excited by the fact that you got through the door and other people didn't, then I think that's a bit sad. So And that's fine. You know, that's, you know, there's clearly a market for that. But I have a very high degree of conviction that that will not make you happy in your soul. It won't give you a deep sense of meaning. It won't give you a sense of love or conviction or ethics or the satisfaction that comes with solving something. You know, you'll be able to swill a martini behind closed doors and, you know, take a selfie. That's, you know, I, as I say, I think that the world is in a place right now where that's, there should be a dwindling market for that. And I think that to be in a place where you're, which is inclusive and welcoming, and the people are wildly smart and very accomplished and are doing really cool things and are bundles of energy. And when you meet them, you want to know more because you find, you know, it evokes a sense of curiosity and indeed passion. That's what you want.
I like Paul. I like the conduit. I got stellar treatment when I went, with a full tour, use of the space, a peppermint tea on the house, and an opportunity to become a member, which I didn't take. I know it's his job to make me feel like that, but I really do believe him and his mission and his sincerity. I think the conduit represents a really interesting subsection of neo-private members clubs. It's a far cry from the archaic establishments that are still living in the 1800s over in Mayfair, where the old members' clubs seem to be driven inward, keeping family lines and ties close together. These new members' clubs seem to be looking outwards, driven by work and purpose. Maybe a representation of the drivers of society today? I'd say the best thing about members' clubs still seems to be the network they offer. You have a chance to rub shoulders with and maybe work with people of great power and influence. The space seems to be like a secondary perk. But let's look at our checklist for a third place. Can you gather easily? Yeah, if you pass the application process and you can afford to live in London. Regularly? Yeah. Pleasurably? Absolutely, with wonderful facilities. Inexpensively? If you have a spare couple hundred pounds or more in your budget a month, maybe. Somewhere neutral you can socialise, interact, and just be. Yes, yes, and yes. Most of the criteria I'd say are checked off, but it got me thinking about the bigger picture. Not many people are able to afford the luxury. The cost of living crisis has hit most of us very hard. That means only a small portion of people are able to enter this space, which by default still makes it an exclusive club to a certain wealth bracket. However, there are now exceptions. The Conduit is opening its doors to university students looking to expand their network and community for free. Other clubs like Albright offer digital membership tiers that give access to the community, if not the physical space. But I think it's important to note that the motivations around these newer clubs is the difference, and what propels them into the future compared to the old ones. Is the idea that third places aren't for everyone, they just have to be right for you? I'm not sure. But this week, I think private members clubs are maybe not for me. Budget is screaming that louder than I am. For now, it's on to the next, and I hope you'll join me through Floating Space. Next time on Floating Space.
I think it's really easy to vilify online spaces as not being real enough.
I used to call this place Home From Home.
Go forth as a confident queer and conquer the world.
A big thank you to all the contributors to this episode. Floating Space is created and hosted by me, Katie Stokes. Artwork is by Allegra Lockstadt. This podcast is powered by Transmission Roundhouse.